Today we are going to discuss the biggest future trends and how businesses and individuals can get ready for this. And I'm very excited to say I'm here with Lars Tweeder, who is an author, an entrepreneur, a futurist. You also manage a hedge fund. So maybe you can share a little bit what you do and how you ended up looking at future trends.
Yeah, so I would say the last 30 years, that's how old I am, but the last 30 years, I've been working with companies where we always had to look into the future. So I have been founding or co-founding, I think it's around 15 companies now, and including a venture capital fund, where of course you need to be really sharp on what's moving. And just about to start a hedge fund. And I also have a group of companies under the umbrella called Supertrends, inspired by a book that I have written twice. I wrote a book called Supertrends in 2009.
Which I really enjoyed, I have to say.
This is a new one, though. The first one had a very different angle, but this is a new one. So yeah.
This came out in 2019, right?
Yeah. And so what happened in 2009, first time I wrote a book called Supertrends, I wanted to promote it online. And then I thought, I'll make a list of 100 things that will happen before 2050. And the book was quite fat, bigger than this one, actually. And I was flipping through it just, you know, easily to find 100 things. And it was amazingly difficult for me to find 100 specific predictions that I could say would happen between 2050. The problem was not, you know, predicting when stuff would happen. I simply didn't have enough specific events. And then I thought, okay, so I'm writing about the meta phenomena that are taking place, but I don't have a map. It's like you sail out to sea without a map, and all you have is kind of hearsay and you know, somebody says, there's an island in that direction, there's a reef in that direction. I hear it's generally bad weather there and so on. So I thought, to be a really efficient investor and also to be a really successful entrepreneur and business planner, you would like to have the best possible map you can of everything that happens in the future. So I bought the domain supertrends.com from an evil squatter who overcharged me a lot. And then I had this idea to make a map where you get descriptions of future events that are important, and then crowdsource opinions about when they will happen. And at that time, I mentioned that to many people, and there was, you know, nobody really responded and so on. But then when we started a venture capital fund, I started thinking about it again. And then I founded a company, and now it's really the Supertrends group of companies. So it's the Supertrends Ventures, where we make companies that work with how to see, understand, and address the future with technology. So data-driven all the way through. And so we're actually launching it the next 2 months with, I think, five clients. So five corporate clients, one financial clients with about 2,000 end users, some companies in the fashion industry, a consulting company, and so on. Yeah, this is, so one of the things that we do is that we have what we call Supertrends Lab. And that is software that goes online and researches everything you can think about concerning some theme. So here I have an example where I was quite interested in fuel cells. So that's because I'm invested in platinum. You need platinum for fuel cells. So I wanted to know, you know, how is that trending and compared to hybrid electric vehicles and to battery electric, etc., and to plug-in hybrid vehicles. So we go out on the net, and then we get these hype indicators that show how much is going on within each of these subjects. So I can see if one of them is accelerating. So here we click on fuel cells, and then you get this word cloud that shows what people are talking about within this area, which companies are also the top 100 sites, the most important stories. And then on the most important stories, we use AI that write very short summaries automatically. And then we check them, and then we send them out in an app that I'll show you in a minute. So here we have, for instance, tweets over time. There's more than 100,000 tweets on fuel cells within 1 year. So nobody can read that. So with this software, we find out what is most important. So That is the labs part, and it's a very, very good way to get just like a dashboard with an overview of what is going on. And here are the aggregate supertrends indices that show the interest in the four different technologies. Interestingly, they are kind of at the same level right now, but that will probably change. So then that goes into smartphone input to some of the stories we have. And on the smartphone, we have the app that goes, that has mapped all human innovation going all the way back to 3.3 million years ago when the first stone tools were made. And now here I'm surfing to 1712, 1744. So every little dot is an innovation. And now I'm going into the future. Of course, that's the most interesting part. So in 2022, we have a lot of predicted events predicted by people who are experts in these areas. So we have a science team that interview experts and they upload events. We make sure they don't overlap, etc. Now we surf to 2026. We see some other events. And I click on one of the events. And this is one that's interesting for me. It's the first rate hike in the US because I'm a finance guy, among other things. I go in and then I rate personally what how important it is, how big the impact on business and society is. And that becomes a part of crowdsourcing because everybody can do that. And everybody also can bookmark, etc. So we can see from all the free users on the free app that we are going to launch, we'll be able to see what where the interest is and then also where people predict that things will happen. There's a news page where you get all this news. So some of it is written by AI, some of it by our science editors. And then you indicate if you think it's interesting, it's not interesting. And you can go in. So here's one I made a prediction on. So I make a prediction and then I can see how my prediction is different from the consensus. And by being active with the app, I create an interest profile. So economy and finance, AI, etc. So this shows some of the things that I am following most. So this is alive. And then you will be able to publish your own personal predictions on social media and also your interest profile. So it's a tool for crowdsourcing what goes on, what people think is interesting, and crowdsourcing a timeline. So we do the crowdsourcing in two ways. We ask the experts who actually work with these specific fields, like if we take cultured meat, we have one section where we only ask people who work with cultured meat when they think the different events in cultured meat happen. And then we ask everybody out there in the world when they think. So we get actually two different timelines. And right now we have no idea how much these timelines will differ. But I think, have you read the book called Super Forecasting?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Super Forecasting, that was came out of a project at DARPA. Maybe I don't know if I should talk about it or you should, but there they found that non-experts, the crowd of non-experts were better at predicting than the experts. Our suspicion in what we work with here is that it will be opposite because in the super forecasting, they were predicting common events like riots, revolutions, military coups, and so on, which normal people could have an idea on. But we don't think that normal people have much idea about fusion power and stuff like that. But time will tell, and it will be very interesting to see when we go live.
So when you look at some of the key trends, then some of the trends that obviously this book was written in 2019. 2020, our world changed completely. What would you say are some of the biggest trends, the biggest macro trends that you are watching very closely at the moment, or everyone should be watching closely?
Yeah, I think if we go to, you know, complete helicopter view, if not space view of what goes on, some of the things that I find most important is that we have commenced, it already began in the 1980s, what you call a dematerialization of our economy. And that means there's a decoupling between the growth of GDP per capita and the growth of GDP and the use of resources. You see that, for instance, in the US, where you have the energy consumption has not been entirely flat, but been pretty close to flat, while the income levels and the population levels have continued to rise. Consumption of many other resources per capita and in total have started to decline. deforestation has stopped. Actually, we have a little bit net, we have a little bit reforestation or rewilding now. So I think this will accelerate and that we will get abundance. And that means there's a fear that has been, it was very, very much when I was young, that we should run out of resources. People don't talk so much about it anymore, but I still hear it. I don't think we ever run out of resources. I think we are, through innovation, rapidly approaching a point where we will have abundance like we won't believe it. There's actually something called an abundance index, which is a calculation of a basket of the 50 most used commodities in the world. And the price of that continues to fall when you deflate it, so when you compare to overall inflation. And the time price, which is how many hours the average citizen in the world needs to work in order to buy that basket of 50 commodities, falls to half every 20 or 18 years. So it's like a Moore's law of abundance that we have here.
Because lots of people argue that actually we're seeing a resource scarcity, that the fight for resources like clean water and other things will increase in the future. So you don't see that?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, people were much more concerned about it. That's where people thought there would be global famine, etc. But you still hear it, yes, and it's not been borne out by the statistical facts. For instance, the global farmland rose from year 1900 to 1980. It rose 30%. And that, of course, that was a problem, because when the farmland grew, it means that we are cutting down forests and destroying natural habitat. But since 1980, it's been pretty much unchanged, even though the global population has doubled and the average nutrition or calorie intake has risen considerably during that time. So we have doubled the output per unit of farmland. And now, and this is a good example, actually, now we have these technologies that are emerging that we can see on the Supertrends timeline. You have plant-based replacement meat. You have cultured meat, where you grow meat cells in stainless steel tanks. And you have vertical farming. And if you take cultured meat, if we imagine that all meat production in the US would switch from farmed meat to cultured meat, then you would free up land areas equal to, I think it's 5 or 6 times the area of Germany. And if you took, if all of the whole world did this, you would free up farmland equal to the size of Russia. What we are looking into, I think, is that we had plateau in farmland starting in the 1980s. It's been flat since. Within a few decades, it will start dropping dramatically, and we can release a lot of land for national parks, etc. Another example is within energy, where if you go back in time, and I actually did a TED talk about this, if you go back to the US government predictions of when the US would run out of oil, in the 1908, 1909, they thought they were running out of oil. Around 1920, they thought there were 60 billion barrels of oil in the world left, because a lot had been burned, 60 billion. Then if you go to 1970, their estimate was that there was, and you know, you keep burning oil, but in 1970, they estimated there were 580 billion barrels left. And you go to today, I mean, they think there's way more than 1,000 billion barrels left. So you can draw a smooth curve that shows, it's not smooth, it's exponential, that shows how they exponentially increased their estimate of how much oil that was left, even though we were burning all the oil we could find all the time. But meanwhile, we changed to new technologies. So we have solar and wind, of course, but it also looks like we will have some radical new technologies coming up. For me, the most interesting at all is nuclear fusion, where you fuse deuterium and tritium. People have said for 60 years that nuclear fusion is 40 years away and will always be 40 years away. But if we look at the consensus estimates on our timeline right now, they say that we'll have sustainable fusion in an experimental reactor in 2025. Now that's 4 years from now. That doesn't mean that we will have electricity generated by such reactors in our grid, because then you have to start fusion reactors that are easy to maintain and so on. That might take 15, 20 years. But it's happening, and it's interesting to see that many things that you predicted on the timeline have been moving. And so we have an automatic alert generator that alerts people when stuff starts to moving radically on the timeline. So what it looks like to me now is that we, by the end of this century, will have at least probably a 90% hydrogen economy. Hydrogen, because deuterium and tritium are actually isotopes of hydrogen, but also hydrogen because hydrogen is a nice fuel. And you're beginning here in Switzerland, you can, there are now fuel stations for trucks with hydrogen. There are quite a lot in Germany also. The EU is making a big drive for hydrogen. And there will, of course, also other technologies. But I think hydrogen would play a very important role, and it's like limitless. So if you and I should get our lifetime consumption of energy from nuclear fusion, the amount of deuterium and tritium we would need personally is really small. So we would need lithium that you can contain in two notebook batteries. That lithium then has to be converted to tritium. And then the deuterium that is contained in one bathtub of tap water. And so if you make these calculations, it turns out that we probably have enough to power the world for billions of years with this. And there's no waste. The waste is helium, which is the most common thing in the world, in the universe, actually. So, and you use it to blow up balloons for children's parties. So that's a very long answer to your question about the main themes. And there was only one theme, and that was...
So I think you cover two. There's this increasing abundance, so we're not really facing a scarcity of resources. And then I guess with energy, you also touched on sustainability. And that was interesting when I read the book, your book, Super Trends, that you said actually you are less worried about climate change and the economy, even though this is a big problem at the moment. You feel that we have the technology and the skills on the horizon at least to change this. And I guess fuel cells and hydrogen energy, that they are examples of this, right?
Yeah, so I think always when you discuss these kind of matters, you have to distinguish between the normative and descriptive. So normative is what you would like to see, and the descriptive is what is likely to happen. And sometimes people mix that up a bit. But I think that if we take the normative, you have three kinds of environmentalists. You have what you call light green, which is people say, I personally want to, live responsibly, clean, and so on. And you can just say that that's definitely good, but it can't really address the problems, because as the wealth in the world rises by about 2% a year, and the population a bit over less than 1% a year. So we need to do more than just think responsibly. Then you have dark environmentalism, and that is a movement where you say, it's so dangerous what we have got going. We have to stop all economic growth and plan for a future where we have to live much more humble. And then we have bright environmentalism, where you say, no, actually, we need to have more wealth. Because first of all, if we look at environmental performance index, which is calculated by number of universities, etc., there's a very clear correlation between the GDP per capita and how high your performance is on environments. And so in the top, for instance, you often had Switzerland, which is a super wealthy country, and the ones in the bottom are really poor countries. So the point is that you can address both resource issues and pollution issues most efficiently through innovation. I am a great, great fan of many science writers, but one of the ones who really blew me away is David Deutsch. I don't know if you've read his book, The Beginning of Infinity. It's like it's an insanely funny and interesting book. I mean, not funny like slapstick funny, but the way he sees things. But at one point, he writes that probably in the Stone Age, there would have been people who would die of cold weather lying on some branches. And why did they do that? Because they had not invented the technology of controlled fire. Okay, so here we are today, and we have not invented the technology of merging deuterium and tritium or making nuclear reactors with thorium. But it's possible. I mean, it doesn't defy the laws of physics. So it's almost a certainty that we will, just as it was probably a certainty that Stone Age people would figure out how to control fire. So the point is that resources is not like a bucket that we are emptying. Resources are the result of innovation. Things that are not resources to us, like deuterium, tritium, proton, and many other things, become resources when we figure out how we can utilize them. And typically, it becomes more and more elegant for every step we take in our innovation. For instance, the power per weight unit of deuterium and tritium in fusion is more than a million times bigger than in cold. So everything gets more compact. This is my smartphone, not very different from most other people's, but it's, we know the whole story about, if you go back 30 years, you would need a massive mainframe and cameras and typewriters and so on. We'll probably fill a whole house with it. And somebody calculated it would have cost $30 million. And I got this phone cheaper. So we are dealing with it. And the way we should address these issues, in my opinion, is that we should invest more in science. And we should also create an environment where innovation startups is attractive, so we get more of it, because moving forward is the way, moving backwards is not the way. That's my opinion about those things.
Very good. And
I think my opinion is based on data.
Yes. So the other trend, when we talked about before, you talk about the three clouds as another big trend. Do you want to talk about this?
Yeah, it's been inspired by, very often when people ask me to do a talk, and then I say, can you talk about the future, like digitalization, for instance? And I think, yeah, I can do that. But digitalization is like what people have been talking about for 30 years. So there's kind of parallel angle that I would like to address. And that is, just as you can divide media or information into bits and bytes, you can also divide other things into very small discrete packages. And so you have the cloud, the IT cloud, which we're using every day, which is smart because I can access on a super flexible basis. I can access computer power and storage power somewhere else out in the cloud. I have no idea where it goes on, actually. And then we have the human cloud. And this came after the internet, that people started to work in the gig economy, where they became freelancers, and then they offer their services to many different people. For instance, a couple of weeks ago, I went on 99 Designs and made a design competition for a logo. And there were, anybody could come and make logo suggestions. I made it as an open competition, so everybody could see all the other inputs. And then I would rate them, and everybody could see what I would rate. So in the beginning, they were going lots of different directions, and then it started to converge in a few directions. So if you ask one of these people, who are all over the world, by the way, who are you working for? That would not be the right question. The right question would be, what are you working on? So these people probably have 20, 50 different competitions going at the same time, maybe also something else. And what happens with the human clouds is that our services get divided into smaller discrete objects. And then you get a marketplace for that. And in a marketplace, the ratings are very important. Like, I rated every suggestion, and that gave feedback. Uber, where you rate the driver rates you. Fantastic. Uber also has variable price on many of these marketplaces, but not 99 Designs. At least I haven't seen that, but they also have fluid market prices. So the whole market in the IT cloud and also in the human cloud, the whole market becomes much more fluent and much more efficient in a macroeconomic sense. And then I think there's a third cloud you can talk about, and that is the cloud of things. So IoT is really taking off now. And what made it take off is partly that, you know, all the sensors that we have in tablets and smartphones, of course, have become so cheap and so good because of the big market for these devices. But also that we had a limitation in the internet protocol that is still dominated by version 4, but the IPv6 has so many different addresses that you could actually, for every square millimeter of the surface of the earth, connect quite a lot of devices. So the limitations are going away. And the last thing we needed was G5, which is can connect an almost incredible number of devices in a local environment. So with the cloud of things, you will have data coming from so many different places, all sorts of data. And the way we'll treat the data will typically will be with big data approaches. So the main difference between big data and not big data is that traditional data, you would do a statistical sampling, you would do it at some point in time and generate a report. But with big data, you normally use all the data. You are not sampling at specific times, but it's going in real time. And you also use AI to extrapolate the data that is missing, a bit like the way our eyes work, because we have a blind spot pretty close to the center of focus, and we can't see it because our brain just extrapolates and puts in what it guesses is invisible to us. So we have this trio of technologies, IoT, big data, and AI, which create the third cloud. But the overall sum of having these clouds is a far more efficient economy, because if I already addressed it with people and with computers, but if you look at the cloud of things, the things can report when they need service. So you can get service not too late, but not too early either. So just in time service, they can order spare parts. I have a friend who worked in a very big company called Bossart selling screws and nails. And they did come and deliver a box. There's a little weight sensor at the button of the box, in which they deliver to a factory. And when the weight comes down to a certain point, they also automatically send a replacement. So it's a very economically efficient trial of the clouds that we are rolling out right now. I'd say the IT cloud, of course, is mature, but the other ones are not.
Very good. Do you feel that the concept of crowdfunding is the secret to unlocking more accelerated innovation?
I certainly think that it plays a big role. It's not the only thing. You have incubators, accelerators, venture funds, angel firms. This is a great concept, and also it allows people to diversify. So the statistics for what happens to startups, as we all know, are not that encouraging, because most startups go belly up pretty soon, but a few of them do extremely well. So you, instead of being invested in one or two, you would rather be invested in 20. And if you have limited means, it becomes much more feasible to do that if you use the crowdfunding.
Very good. Some of these big trends, then, what do they mean for individuals? So how, as an individual, how do I prepare for this? If there will be lots of people listening to this thinking, okay, that we see all these technology shifts towards digitalization, cloud, AI, data, we see some of the bigger macroeconomic trends. What do individuals do? How do they prepare to succeed in this new future?
So I have one thing that I think is really important, that is very often when you hear about fantastic stuff, then everybody thinks they have to go in that direction, but it's not everything is for everybody. I think the first thing you should do is try to know yourself. I'm a big fan of doing this online personality tests. I've done a lot myself, and I found that they're actually very accurate, at least the ones I've done, and find out which kind of person you are, and that will tell you which kind of job or work that you will thrive with. So if you go into this world where in the gig economy, where it's like you have to fight for every client, on the other hand, maybe you're fighting for so many projects that there's no real risk of having nothing to do, but there's a risk perhaps of having less to do, perhaps also more to do during some times. But other people, they're actually much more happy in a more fixed environment where they go to the work every day. Some people cannot work alone because they get energy from being surrounded by a group of people in a room, except now in COVID. So I think that's the start. But but a couple of things I would say is that I think that everybody should plan for a more wealthy world. Did say that GDP per capita rises about 2% a year, a bit less, but with compound effect, it is about 20% every 10 years. In 100 years, the world, the average income per capita in real terms will probably be 6 to 7 times as high as it is now. I would assume that places that are really poor in Africa at that time will have a standard of living which is equal to Germany today, if not a lot higher. So there are many ways to plan for that, you know, invest in equities, keep investing in equities your whole life, but also assume that the people will move up the Maslow pyramid of needs. We see that here in Verbier, where I'm sitting right now, there are lots of local people who are mountain guides, ski guides, bartenders, selling skis and so on. You ask them what their parents did, they were farmers, so they were producing food. So basic needs, very low in the pyramid. Skiing is very high in the pyramid. Some of them are also doing yoga training and mindfulness and so on. So what happens is that technology is, it's far easier to use technology to automate what is at the bottom of the pyramid. So these jobs disappear, which is generally good because many of these jobs are quite repetitive. But then you get more and more jobs at the top of the pyramid. I think some people are concerned about structural unemployment, but there's something called Say's Law that says that supply creates its own demand. So even though that on average, humans are probably like 200 to 400 times as productive as in the Stone Age, we don't have 99.something% unemployment. No, we are pretty close to full employment in most economies. And that is because we just keep replacing one thing with another. So I think that will continue to happen. And that means that when you consider where to work, where there will be jobs or gigs, it's most likely to be at the high end of Maslow's pyramid of needs. So that's worth considering. Mm.
You're not worried about artificial intelligence and robots taking all the jobs, which I agree with. I think there's that we'll have more jobs, we'll have different jobs, it will all transition to a new world. But you talk about gig economy. So what do you think will be the balance of, will there be 50% of people working in traditional employment and 50% in gig economy jobs, or will we see a slow transition where everyone basically is a free agent that has a set of skills that they can then hire out to different organizations or different projects that need them? So what sort of balance do you see, and how fast do you see this transition happening?
I don't see that everything will become gig economy for the reason that I mentioned earlier, that some people prefer a different environment. So it will find its new balance. It's a little bit like some years ago, the book market, you have written, 18 books? I've written 17. So we've both spoken a lot with publishers, but I don't know if they talk with you about the catastrophic decline in the book readership. Some years ago, but the decline stopped. So it fell down to a lower level and then stabilized there and seems quite good now. So I think it'll just reset to another level. But it was interesting with COVID that so many of us, including the two of us, not right now, working from home. Mm-hmm. Then I read studies about how many people in each economy actually can do their work from home. And in wealthy countries like UK and Switzerland, where we are, US, Denmark, and so on, it's about 50% of the population who can work from home. And a lot of us find that it's actually more productive. So I have become more productive during COVID than I was before because I don't feel any obligation to travel to meetings. We do it online and save a lot of time.
Yeah, I have so many of these conversations now with people all over the world, and everyone that is in a similar environment that we are in feels exactly the same. I feel probably twice as productive at the moment in terms of what I can achieve in a day. Will urbanization be reversed in the near future?
It is a very interesting question, and I'd like to start with something that really surprised me, because everywhere you read that urbanization is continuing at a blistering pace. But there was somebody who wrote that if you look at satellite photos, it's actually not true anymore. So I'm not quite sure about that. I don't know, Bernard, if you have seen anything about that. Of course, it depends how you define what is urban or suburban or satellite urban or whatever.
It is very interesting. I think it's still too early to know, but I think I live in the UK, and what I'm seeing is that big city centers are much emptier now, obviously, but I also see that lots of the big companies are now selling real estate, rethinking what they will do. So in the past, everyone was drawn towards big cities like London, and mainly because everything revolved around work, that you'd go there. You work in the office, then you go to restaurants at lunchtime, afterwards you go for a drink and so on. So I think for me the key is that that city centers actually rethink how they define themselves, and especially more around a social and cultural draw to bring people in. And urbanization, I think in the past was people move there because of work. I think now they will move to places where they get the best work-life balance, where they get access to nature, where they get access to good restaurants and theaters, and that will become much more important. So I could imagine a shift towards other areas where people feel actually, even though these cities had the big companies in the past, they were not the most attractive places to be, and we will see a shift.
Yeah, I have a comment. I actually write something about it in the Supertrans book. So transportation has historically meant a lot for urbanization. So it was the suburbs became possible because of the mass production of cars. Now with electric cars and self-driven cars, well, electric cars are there now, but also with micromobility. So you'll have less cars driving around in the cities, and you also free up a lot of the parking space. And that means that you can make more outdoor cafes, etc. And electric cars are more silent than other cars, so it gets more silent there, gets more clean, you get more cafes, you get maybe discos in the former parking houses or whatever they are, some of them are converted into. So that speaks for the cities. So it speaks from moving from the suburbs back to the cities. But then when cars become completely self-driven, so you can actually go in and sleep when it drives you back, that will again speak for the suburbs, but we are not there yet. And then when we get the quadcopters, to the degree that we get permitted to really use them in big numbers, then you'll have this, you know, you can take off from the city in a quadcopter, and then you can fly out to a summer house, which might be 3 hours drive away, but it's only 1 hour or 45 minutes in your quadcopter. And that will open up a market for these more remote vacation areas. So I think that the lifestyle we are drifting towards is that a lot of people, partly for lifestyle reasons, would like to have residence in the cities, but they also would like to have a residence outside, closer to nature, and transportation will that make that more and more possible or feasible.
Very good. And once all the farming goes, we'll have lots of space to and recreation.
Yeah. So if we get a dramatic decline in the global farming areas during the rest of this century, which is, I think we spoke a little bit about that earlier. So we get all these national parks. One thing that I think will increase is hunting, because we would be concerned with having lots of predators that are really dangerous for humans. So we still like ourselves to be at the top of the food chain. And so there will be a lot less farming, but there will be a lot more hunting. That's my guess. And maybe with all this land, you will have these small places where you have huts and houses out in the nature and small areas, and then people will come in their quadcopters. That's kind of how I imagine that is going within the next 50 years or so.
So, and what does it mean for businesses? So we talked about individuals, as a business, you obviously work with lots of other business leaders, you're running a number of businesses yourself, and you see lots of businesses that are successful and maybe some of them that are not so successful in getting ready and preparing for those shifts that we're seeing happening. And what I'm seeing is that the innovations are speeding up, that change will only get faster in the future. So how do organizations put them in a position to be successful in this new world? What are some of your top tips to say, okay, if you are running a business, what do we need to do to make sure we succeed in this new world?
Yeah, there are a number of things you can do. I actually make a list of 20 things in the book. So you can delegate within your team. So try to decentralize your team. About half a year ago, it's longer ago, but I visited an organization in Holland called Boerzorg, and they do home care for elderly and ill people. And the people who started it, or the person who started it, he came from the public system, which was very centralized, where they even had pin codes that they put on people's door, and then with a phone they would check in, and some economists would measure who was fastest at doing what and so on. So it was completely like industrialized and not very human. And then he thought I was very bad, and then they made Boerzorg, where they have teams of maximum 10 people, and there's no control system at all. Everybody regulate themselves. And they go out when first time they meet a patient, it's mandatory. They sit and have coffee and talk, and they talk with their relatives, they talk with their neighbors and so on. So Boerzorg is expanding at a blistering pace. It's very successful in Holland. The average cost of doing this with Boerzorg is about 45% cheaper than when the state does it. The employees in Boerzorg, which is now a large organization, so they measure employee satisfaction in organizations with more than 1,000 employees. Boerzorg employees are the most satisfied employees in Holland, and the patients are far more happy with Boerzorg than with the state service. So this is an example of what you can achieve when you decentralize. And there are many IT companies that are also very good at it, like Spotify has a very set concept for decentralizing. Even how they create physical areas of a decentralization. Every team can release, so they release something that is initially invisible to the clients to see if it creates any destabilization. You do A/B release, test it a little bit, nothing bad happens, and then they release the whole thing. So a decentralization is, and empowering people in that way is very important. And I think there's something that we should always bear in mind, that we have, I'll see if I can do this right, but you have three things that are important in decision making. So this, the insight in what goes on, it's power to decide, and then the consequences of what you decided. So if you have the small house on the prairie, little family there, all isolated, these things are very close together. So if they made a mistake, they're not going to repeat it. But when you take the power to decide and remove it from the inside and remove it for the consequences, as happens in centralization, you get a lot of bad effects. The decentralization is very important. Then I think to create a meta organization where you work with people around outside the formal organization is very important. When I did the logo competition, I got more than 300 suggestions for people I never met. So that's very, very decentralized. But you can set up an accelerator if you're a corporate, an incubator, a venture fund, or take, you know, set up a venture fund with some other companies. So you get this flow, deal flow, and you see all the things that startups are working with, and you invest in some of them. You can systematically buy up companies. I have a daughter who studied business economics, but she was an intern at Hilton Group, and they did Dragon's Den competitions, where they awarded some money to the best ideas, which was super motivating for everybody because they are listened to, and that means that they are all the time thinking about what can I come up with that makes this business better. Mm-hmm. You can do like innovation prizes, like XPRIZE. There was one, a great example was, it's quite a number of years ago, but IBM they had a number of core technologies because they were very good. They are very good at core science, but they were not sure that they had figured out what these core technologies could be used for. And then they made a huge innovation competition where they invited employees, spouses of employees, university students, clients, etc., to come with proposals for application. And they got a completely overwhelming number of ideas, which they then narrowed down to a smaller number. Mm. So many other things like that, an app store, open API, etc. Everything where you can include other people. Also, what you do so well, I also do it, but you do it like a 10,000 better than me, is that you go on social media, you talk about what you're interested in, maybe just you see a story written by somebody else, you share it, you write very briefly why you find that interesting. You get feedback. Mm. So all the people, you're in your case, like 2 million people, right? So you have 4 million, Bernard Ma has 4 million eyes and ears. Mm. But if you didn't use social media, you would have two of each. So these people, they're looking out in the world for things that are interesting to you, and they're feeding back to you, and you're feeding back to them. And to mobilize the whole world for what you're interested in that way is so efficient.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's so vital to have those social networks that you listen to and engage with and have communications with. This is why we're doing these sessions, to exactly do that. Mm-hmm. Listen to you, to listen to everyone listening here and hopefully listening to their comments and questions. I couldn't agree more. And I think businesses that do this well will become more successful in the future.
And it goes back to something that is very fundamental. So I wrote a book. This one was called The Creative Society. And the book is about how creativity actually appears in a system. And so the specific system that it focused most on was Western Europe, because creativity took off like a rocket in Western Europe around year 1450. And I couldn't figure out why at first. And then I saw somebody, actually via social media, somebody just sent me an animation of European borders going back since, you know, before the Roman Empire. And I just looked at that. It was loud music, and you saw all these borders changing all the time in this animation. And then you saw the Roman Empire certainly collapses. And then Europe gets split into, at one point, there was 5,000 different city-states in Europe. And then it started to consolidate in big kingdoms again, many places. But you had this band that was northern Italy, Switzerland, Germany, some of eastern France, the Netherlands, Belgium, some of northern Europe, that remained incredibly decentralized for 500 years, longer than the rest. And then I looked at that and I thought, that pattern, I've seen that pattern somewhere. And where I had seen that pattern, you know, of this decentralized place, was actually two places I've seen it. One is something called the blue banana. The blue banana is like drawn as a banana that covers exactly that area. And this is the most wealthy part of Europe, and it's also the part of Europe with the highest population density. But the other place I've seen it was in a book written by Charles Murray, who's a social scientist in the US. And he had done an incredibly interesting study. So he had up to 50 people sitting for 5 years and reading 163 encyclopedias and writing down how much is written about every person that is mentioned. And then they said any person who has made some kind of accomplishment and who is mentioned in at least half of these encyclopedias must be a significant person. And then they mapped where did these people live when they did what is so important that it goes into all these encyclopedias. So 97% of it was, that it covered 2,850 years until 1950. 97% was from Western civilization. And it turns out it came from Western Europe and the areas that had been populated by people migrating from Western Europe. But within Western Europe, half of it was in the blue banana, which is 0.2% of the world's land mass and like 1 or 2% of the world's population during that period. So then I tried to overlap the maps of this human accomplishment or innovation with the blue banana and with the city states. And I found out the decentralization with the city states must have been decisive because they overlap so well. I actually have some slides on it if we have time for it. But I think if you have a room, you go in, Bernard, you do a speech, you have a question, and there's 200 people in the room. You want the people to come up with solutions to a problem. I think the most efficient way to do it is that you ask people to divide into groups of two or three. So lots of groups of two or three, then they sit independently, not talking with other ones. And then afterwards, they each come up with their solutions. So you will have maybe 30, 50 solutions. And then everybody can see them. Maybe everybody can rate. And then you say, okay, we'll do it again now. So now we divide into small groups again, but now you've seen what everybody did. You do that number of times, you will have far better results than if the whole group had simultaneously tried to solve it. And this is what happens when you have city states, when you have meta organizations, when you crowdsource, et cetera. It's that you send it out, many people work independently on it. And it's what happened with 99 Designs when I had my logo made. And there's even a theory that human species developed so relatively rapidly because of a similar thing in climate. So what you had in Africa, the climate would change between that you had jungle and you had savanna, jungle, savanna, jungle, savanna. So the pre-humans were much better off in the jungle. In the savanna, there was not that much food and they were super visible to the predators. So whenever you had savanna, the population sizes shrunk to almost extinction, and then you got inbreeding. And we all know that inbreeding is mostly bad, but it does change. I mean, it is innovation. And then when the climate got better, you had all these different tribes then again connected in the jungle. But then because of the inbreeding, they have become different. And then you would have survival of the fittest. And then they were separated again. So it's like the rhythm that you want to do. That I did on 99 Designs. Some people said this is the same phenomenon that created human through a very intense speciation because of climate change.
Fascinating. Who do you think, or which groups do you think are you worried about that might be missing out based on some of the predictions around social and technological change and innovation that you've outlined? Any particular groups, and are there any specific capabilities that we would need? Any areas and groups that might be potentially vulnerable?
I think people who would like to do a routine work that can be replaced by AI or robots can easily be left out. And that there have been lots of studies, lots and lots of studies of which groups will be replaced by that. But people who are not good at or interested in or lucky with changing to working up Maslow's the pyramid of needs can get in trouble. By the way, I personally, now we move from descriptive to the normative. Personally, I'm actually a fan of basic income, but not because I think that we'll have systemic unemployment because of technology, but because I think that the elaborate welfare states that we have now in many cases actually trap people in a victim position where they go on benefits and then they don't have incentives to get out of the situation that they've gotten into. So I think a modest basic income where everything you do to better your own life will actually benefit you might be more efficient. I hope that will be tried out in large scale somewhere so we can see if that will work.
Yeah, I think the universal basic income is currently being tested in different places.
It has been a lot with some very good results and some very bad results. So we have a lot to learn. Mm.
Very good. So this hour has raced by. What if you leave us with some of your top three future predictions, top tips? Anyone listening from the business world worried about their own world and their own career, what are some of the top tips that, or some of the key points you would like people to remember or take away from today?
In a changing world, so I think I repeat some of the things I've already said, that in a rapidly changing world, test yourself, find out which role you want to play. I think it's a universally very good advice. Plan for abundance. Consider whether you want to be in the gig economy or in a fixed position. And also, if you are in the gig economy, it means that you have no fixed work time, no fixed workplace probably, no fixed pension age. And for instance, if you have small children, then you can work less during a period, and then later you can work a lot more, and so on. I personally completely thrive with having that flexibility, but it's something I think is very important for people to really think about quite deeply.
Great. I agree. If anyone wants to connect with you, Lars, or find out more, where can they do that?
The best is on LinkedIn. You can have 30,000 friends, and I'm not you, so I don't have that. So I say I accept everyone, except if there's something really dodgy. So befriend me on LinkedIn.
Very good. This is a great advice. Thank you so much, Lars. Hopefully we will do this again at some point, because we could have carried on for another 3 hours just talking about all these fascinating future trends. So I really appreciate your time today.
Good.
So we'll end here. Thank you very much. You all have a good day, and I will hopefully see you soon. Thank you.